Sports Out of Time, Season 2, Episode 3, Opening Pitch. Randall, have you ever been in an actual honest-to-goodness fight?
No, never. Never in my life, because I know better than to ever get in a fight. I don't have any fighting skills. No, I can give you, when I was in grade school, I don't even remember what grade, probably fourth, maybe fifth. We were playing some sort of a game outside at recess. And I remember, like, that there were teams. I don't know. I don't even know what we were doing.
Like an off the wall type game?
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I decided that I was frustrated. So I yelled something at the team, called them some sort of name. What it is, I don't remember. And one of the kids on that team decided just to punch me in the head. But luckily, one of my teammates, he took care of it from there.
Oh, so he backed you up. You had muscle behind.
I didn't do anything. All of a sudden, this kid was, he was taken care of. So, that fighting was not it's not part of my DNA.
I got beat up a couple times. I don't know if that counts as being in a fight. I mean, I fought back, right? Like, I gave it my best effort. Here's my problem. I'm one of those kind of guys who, when, like, they get their ass kicked, when, like, the guy's on top, he's like, "Do you surrender?" And I'm like, no, your mom sucks. You know what I mean? Like, I can't admit defeat. I can't stop. So yes and no. I don't win, if that's what you mean. But speaking of fights today, something I've been waiting to talk about for longer than I can imagine. The greatest fight I have ever seen. I'm so excited to talk about this, Randall.
Yeah, can't tell you. I know you are.
I don't understand sometimes, because I think of myself as a pretty self-aware guy, and I don't understand why in 2023 I still care so much about boxing, and not even just that, but I still care about, like, boxing from, like, the 1980s through the 1990s, and then a little bit in the 2000s, and that's about it. Like, that's what I think of that I'm still interested in. Like, I didn't even watch this Tyson Fury fight that happened last weekend.
Okay, I was going to ask you if you had.
No, neither did I.
I
know he won. I'm not interested in boxer versus somebody else in a boxing match. If this was, like, a mixed martial arts event where Ngannou had a chance, now I'm interested, right? But, God, come on.
But isn't that what boxing has turned into? I mean, who's the Paul? Is it Jake Paul?
Jake Paul, Logan Paul, the fighter, the Paul brothers. Yeah,
I don't know which one it is, but I mean,
both of them.
Okay,
yeah.
So they're like a gimmick now in all combat communities, right?
Yeah,
they're doing everything, right?
I mean, Logan Paul in his last fight beat somebody up and then called out a professional wrestler for a pro wrestling match because he's also an active WWE wrestler. So Logan Paul is all over the board in terms of being Jake Paul, on the other hand, and again, I'm not the biggest fan of the Paul brothers. Jake Paul does seem to be a legitimately talented boxer who could probably have a career. My problem with him is that he lines up fights against losers and just beats the crap out of losers. I'd like to see him fight somebody of similar boxing credentials where I could actually get an idea of how good this guy is.
The body. See him look down, and he fainted with the jab and came with the right hand. So there was nuance to what he did. It wasn't just a wild right hand. And boy, oh boy, that just flattened Tyron Woodley.
And Jake Paul gets his Christmas wish.
He didn't get a knockout in the fifth, but he did get it early.
He wanted a knockout. He got it.
He got it in the sixth round.
Yeah. So, but to me, it seems like that's where boxing's at. It's kind of gimmicky now. Unfortunately, very gimmicky, right? Yeah,
and it's a shame because what we're talking about today, the war as it's known, the fight, the great fight on April 15th, 1985, between Marvelous Marvin Hagler and Tommy the Hitman Hearns. You know, we're going to get into it in great detail, but like, there is no such thing as boxing like this anymore. This is boxing on a level that, this is like what you imagine boxing is in your head, not what most boxing matches really are. And it's
yeah, absolutely.
And I know we talked about it during the episode, but Randall, you had not really seen this until we talked about it for this episode. What were your lingering thoughts now after we recorded this about this fight?
Well, my thoughts were right after we recorded the main segment, which is coming up. My interest in boxing had been piqued, right? I'm like, wow, yeah, this is amazing to watch. And, you know, I did some YouTube dives on previous fights and things like that. And I did see that this Tyson Fury fight was coming up, but I'll be honest, I didn't go any further than that.
No.
because, you know, I don't even know. Was this Fury fight? It was probably pay-per-view, wasn't it? I don't even know.
Yes, yeah, pay-per. You would, yeah. I mean, if I was going to watch it, I would have found some other way to watch it that wasn't paying $60. I mean, the internet exists, guys. I hate to say it, but
But I didn't want to go through that much effort. So
yeah, it's not worth the time. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Finding this fight on YouTube, by the way, folks, is worth your time. So this is one of those rare instances where I would say, if you're listening to this at home as opposed to in your car, maybe toss this fight on YouTube real quick because it's not too long, and I think it's worth watching even before we get into the conversation. I think it's not the worst idea to watch it.
It's a great idea.
Now this is a pretty long episode because it's a Mr. Familaro episode, which means there's some deep history we get into. So I don't want to spend too much time, but I do want to set the table here for us, Randall. Yes. So why don't we take a quick side trip in our pop culture time machine back to April 15th, 1985. I would have been -7 months old.
Okay.
I was on the way in January of 86. How old were you in 1985, Randall?
I would have been 12 at the time, headed towards 13.
12 headed towards 13, a good age maybe for some of our for our conversation today. Yeah. So let's get into it. If you were going to the movies on April 15th, 1985 to see the number one movie in America, I can't believe it. You'd be going to see Police Academy 2, Their First Assignment.
They're armed.
Now look, I'm serious.
And they're dangerous. Mahoney.
You have the right to sing the blues.
You have the right to cable TV.
It's a nice piece.
Tackleberry.
I was referring to your sidearm.
Hightower.
Yo!
Yo?
Yo, sir!
Jones. Hooks.
Oh, dirtbag!
Captain Lazard.
All right. I'm ready for this one, man. Police Academy 2 follows a new group of misfit recruits at the beleaguered police academy as they embark on their first assignment, led by the unorthodox Officer Mahoney. Mahoney? Steve Guttenberg. The squad faces uproarious challenges and eccentric superiors aiming to prove their worth in law enforcement. Randall, what do you remember about this movie at 12 years old?
Well, at 12 years old, I was not allowed to go see this movie in the movie theater. So I didn't see it until years later on video cassette, I'm assuming. obviously, at this age, right, I was 12, 13, 14. Obviously, I enjoyed this film as I did Police Academy. Right. I mean, how could you not at that age? And I don't know if you recall, Sam, but we have a Steve Guttenberg in our home. It's on a shelf above our couch. So we're obviously huge fans of Steve Guttenberg. And I think it mostly comes from his work on Police Academy, maybe a little bit on Cocoon, but mostly Police Academy.
See, I'm from the generation that remembers him from the Disney Channel original film Tower of Terror, starring Steve Guttenberg. This is well past when his star had fallen back to Earth.
I mean, Three Men and a Baby, that whole thing was a big, big deal for him as well.
So Police Academy is, I'm trying to think of what the equivalent for these type of movies would have been for my generation. I guess maybe like the Scary Movie franchise, like those are objectively kind of bad movies, but I'll still ride for the first two of them as being pretty funny because I saw them at the right age.
Yeah. Was now these predate Naked Gun. right? That would have been along the same lines, right?
Around the same time, I think. Naked Gun movies, mid to late 80s, I would think. Okay. Those movies were already out when I was
okay. So okay, a little ahead of your time.
Yeah, a little ahead.
Just a smidge.
I barely remember the Naked Gun movies.
Okay.
If you were, I know you've probably already seen this. What do you think the ratings were for this movie? Think they were good or bad?
Oh, I can't imagine they're good. I honestly did not look because I know I have notes, but I didn't look past what you read.
Well, shockingly, this film received negative reviews. It currently has a 29 on Rotten Tomatoes, if that does anything for you. Film critic Leonard Maltin gave this movie a bomb rating, all capitals on bomb. The first of five movies in his entire career that he actually did this for. So again, a good list. There are Dragnet episodes that are funnier than this movie, said Leonard Maltin, which is a great line. While Siskel and that is good, right? Yeah. Siskel and Ebert didn't actually review this on its own, but they did include it on the 1985 episode of their television show that was focused solely on terrible movie scenes.
Okay. Wow. There were plenty of them in 1985, I guess, that were just terrible.
Just a bunch of really bad movies. I do like this, though. Gene Siskel noted that this movie has two more laughs than the 1984 original, which meant it has exactly two laughs.
Wow.
Well, here's something you can laugh about, Police Academy 2. They were laughing all the way to the bank. On a budget of $7 million, this movie made $115 million in 1985. So
right.
I'm sure the Police Academy folks and Steve Guttenberg didn't care too much what Maltin, Ebert, and Siskel had to say about their films.
Not at all.
After you left the movie theater in 1985, you could have gotten in the car and driven home and listened to the number one song in America, We Are the World by USA for Africa. We can't go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere will soon make a change. We are a part of God's great big family. And the truth, you know, love is all we need. We are the world. We are the children.
Do you have to?
You don't. I mean, you can change the channel after you hear that it's on. I'm sure it's on somewhere. This is like a song that I kind of only understand as like a concept that like people came together to sing this song. I know the chorus of it, but I feel like I missed out on this being a cultural thing that I would have had to deal with in any particular way.
Yeah, you did miss out.
Like, was this on the radio all the time?
It was. And the video, have you seen the video?
I have not seen the video. They're standing around
in a studio. It's not even a good video. Right. But of course, everyone's, oh, there's Michael Jackson. Oh, there's Lionel Richie. There's whomever. Right. Everyone's so excited to see them like they haven't seen a music video with them in it before.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find the list of everybody who we're talking about here. So you got Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers, Tina Turner, Billy Joel, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Diana Warwick, Willie Nelson, Bruce Springsteen, Kenny Loggins, Steve Perry, Daryl Hall, but not John Oates for some reason.
Really?
Huey Lewis, not the News for some reason. Cyndi Lauper, Bob Dylan, Ray Charles, and then, weirdly, Dan Aykroyd. So a lot.
What? Yeah, I was good. You know, I was listening to that list and I was trying to see if all those names held up. And obviously Dan Aykroyd is not a singer, but they all hold up, right? I mean, those are all iconic singers still.
Huge stars.
There was no flash in the pan in that list, right?
No. And it makes sense why it was such a cultural. I can't imagine that today, if the biggest, like if Taylor Swift and, you know, Kendrick Lamar and the biggest rock, whoever, like U2, all came out together and did a song together, I'm sure it would be number one in the country for a while. It would capture our interest.
Yeah, probably. But I mean, well, this was very specific. It was for charity. It was, you know.
Correct.
And
correct.
I'm assuming you're saying for the same reasons, right?
Yeah, for the same reasons. Yeah, like people would get behind it in the same way.
Yeah, oh, I think so too. I do.
Song was released on March 7th, 1985, first single from the album. Huge worldwide commercial success, top music charts throughout the world, the fastest selling pop single in history. It went quadruple platinum, the first single to be certified multi-platinum, got four Grammy Awards, an AMA, a People's Choice Awards. So again, it was certainly a great success, and I'm sure it helped a lot of people. Does that mean that I have to listen to the song ever again? God, no, it's not very good.
But we're going to make them listen to it on the podcast, right? Just a little bit, maybe?
Just a little snippet. Just a little. Maybe some more right here.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the one to make a brighter day. So let's start giving. Oh, there's a choice we're making. We're saving our lives. It's true, we make a better day. Just you and me.
All right. So finally, you can get home and with your brain fried from having to listen to We Are the World and watching Police Academy. You're like, let me give myself some culture. The number one book in America, Family Album by Danielle Steele.
Oh, wow.
So I feel like when you talk about Danielle Steele, a name that's always going to pop up in here, because Danielle Steele had a million novels. This is her 18th novel.
18th, but I'm sure that list has grown exponentially. I have no idea what that number would be now.
I'm sure it's massive. Wow. It tells the story of Faye Price from World War II until her death in the present day. Relates her professional life as an actress in Hollywood's golden era to finally becoming one of the first female directors in Hollywood. Also focuses on her family life, her marriage, birth of her child, separations and reconciliations with her husband, raising her children. So really just the whole life story of Faye Price, right?
Okay.
Sure. If this is your thing, sounds fine.
Have you ever read a Danielle Steele novel?
No. And I only remember them because I feel like I would see them in the grocery store in like the paperback book section all the time.
Sure.
I want to say that my grandmother, either my grandmother Josephine or my grandmother Evelyn or both, probably had a few of these books sort of floating around the house. I don't believe that my mom ever read them or my sisters ever read them, but they were around. You saw them everywhere.
You still do. You still do. I mean, at the airport, like you said, grocery stores, probably at Costco. But I mean, obviously she must be a good writer. I mean, clearly in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never read them. So it's hard to, you know, I mean, it's probably, you know, it's one of those things that you're like, oh, it's Danielle Steele. But I mean, I've never read it. I have no
hate in my heart for people who want to be successful. This is why Paul McCartney is my favorite of the Beatles. Some people just want to make hits and they want to keep making hits and people like what they like. And that's it. You can make fun of Danielle Steele. Danielle Steele, much like Police Academy, is laughing all the way to the bank.
All the way to the bank.
This did actually get an adaptation, although not a movie adaptation. It was a 1994 NBC television miniseries that was aired over two nights on October 23rd and 24th of 1994.
You were cold. I gave you my jacket. It was probably that moment I fell in love with you.
She's something, isn't she? All the other performers are having dinner with the general, and she's with the guys that didn't see the show.
Real iced tea with actual cubes of ice.
Mm-hmm.
You must be well connected, Lieutenant.
Well, it's not exactly 21, but there is more hash if you want.
Thanks, but these costumes don't allow for seconds.
This was not very good, though, according to David Hildebrand of People magazine. This hackneyed attempt to blend Hollywood glamour with family values is cosmetically appealing. But underneath that veneer crawls the worms of artifice, predictability, and bad acting.
Oh, that's too bad.
Michael Watkins, however, was nominated for an Emmy Award for Outstanding Cinematography. So at least one thing was recognized as being all right here in this version.
And it was an Emmy-nominated television show.
Yeah, take that, David Hildebrand from People magazine in 1994. So there you are. You're in the right headspace maybe not the right headspace, but you're in the correct headspace for what you're about to see and listen to, of course, the greatest boxing match I've ever seen, and I wasn't even born for it. Marvelous Marvin Hagler, Tommy the Hitman Hearns, The War. I've been thinking about this story for like 15 years. I think about this all the time. Yeah, so before we get into anything proper with this story, with the characters that are involved, and maybe the greatest boxing fight that I've ever watched in my life, not live, obviously, I wasn't born, but
right.
The match that's left the most impact on me, I got to shout out a couple people here. Number one,
sure,
I need to shout out my grandfather, Joseph Serrar. Joseph Serrar, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather growing up, and he loved boxing. He's the guy.
Okay.
Yeah, he's from the era when boxing was the sport of kings.
Yeah,
still.
Exactly. I think, for sure.
I want to say, I could be wrong here. Someone can fact check me. I believe he did some light gold gloves level-ish boxing when he was in the army. So I think he had some connection there. So he was the first person who really, I remember watching boxing. Like, he was watching the Tyson fights, you know, along with my dad and other folks. The second person is my former Brooklyn roommate, high school friend, one of my closest friends, Adam Goldstein. Shout out to Adam Goldstein, because Adam Goldstein, one night years ago when we were talking about boxing around the apartment, said, "Oh, dude, you never seen the Hagler Hearns fight? Pull it up on YouTube. It's awesome." And yes, it was.
That's what he sounds like?
No, but people will know what I'm doing. People who know him will get it. They'll get it.
Gotcha.
They'll understand. That's kind of what he sounds like. Shout out to Adam. Love him. One of my closest friends. Because he's the first person who brought this fight to my attention. I've been thinking about it ever since, so I have to thank him for that. And then number three, folks, if you like boxing or even interested remotely in boxing, you should go to YouTube and check out the YouTube channel Rummy's Corner, R-U-M-M-Y. Okay. So Rummy is one of those people who I've never met and obviously will not meet unless something weird happens. But he seems like the kind of person I would like, because he has two YouTube channels, one about boxing history and then one about Twin Peaks and The Sopranos. So I'm like, oh, this is me. This guy's me. Like, all right. I love it. And I bring him up because I watched a documentary in prep for this called Fab Four, which breaks down the history of a lot of these four characters. And it's really excellent. If you have 35 minutes and you like boxing, it's a really nice breakdown of a lot of the stuff that we might skim over in the beginning here. So,
yeah.
I just wanted to get those out of the way. Let's talk about boxing, Randall. When I say boxing to you, what generation, what person, what image sticks out in your mind the most?
Probably Mike Tyson would be the one boxer that I would think of first.
Mike Tyson just goes headhunting. Richard Steele, the third man in the ring, has got his work cut out with Mike Tyson. Oh, the right hand! I doubt if he'll be able to get up from this. He hit him flush on the jaw with the right hand. It's up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah. He was unavoidable. He was so famous and so popular, and everybody loved him. And I know that people sort of laugh about it. You cannot discount the fact that he had a Nintendo game. He had Mike Tyson's Punch Out. That was a big deal. It was a huge deal for a lot of people.
Punch Out by Nintendo. 11 world-class contenders. Take them down with your controller, beat them all, and you've got a shot at Tyson's title. Power! But for that, you've got to beat Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson's Punch-Out from Nintendo. Now you're playing with power.
I think that's right. And for people of our age, we were really lucky in the 1990s to have what I think is the best run of heavyweight boxing the world has ever seen. Again, go to Rummy's Corner channel, watch his hour and 15 minute video about the history of 90s heavyweight boxing. It is amazing. It's amazing how many good fights there were. But if we're talking about the 1980s, what people will sometimes call the golden decade of boxing, boxing fans were absolutely spoiled by what people occasionally refer to as the four kings of boxing. Names you may or may not have heard of, some of the greatest nicknames in boxing history: Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, Tommy the Hitman Hearns, and Roberto Hands of Stone Duran. The four kings would come to dominate 1980s boxing in the ring, and this is the year that boxing really kicks off in a major way for the American public.
Everyone's fighting for something.
To see Ali's career, man, you were looking for somebody to step into that void.
The golden boy, the perennial underdog, the Latin American idol, and Mr. Detroit.
The four kings gave us maybe the greatest period in the history of the sport.
Boxing seems to always have a connection with the battles going on in life.
I'm going to get the two other guys out of the way, because today we're focusing on Tommy the Hitman Hearns and Marvelous Marvin Hagler. But I do want to talk about Durant, okay. Durant and Leonard for a second. It might be worth it in the future for me to do a deep dive into Roberto Hands of Stone Durant. He's a really fascinating boxer. The two major fights that year of 1980, the very first year of the 80s, of course, were between Leonard and Durant. That's right. These two top boxers fought each other twice in the same calendar year, which is outrageous. They fought twice in 1980.
It is absolutely insane.
So on June 20th, Roberto Duran moves up from lightweight to outbrawl Sugar Ray Leonard in Montreal to capture the WBC welterweight title. It's a back and forth fight, but by the end, even though Leonard sources to make adjustments and comes back a little bit, he's built up a lot of a lead and the decision holds. There is some controversy at the time. There's some issue about whether this is a majority decision or a unanimous decision. Regardless of whether you believe one or the other, Duran did win on all three scorecards officially and became the new WBC champion. A great moment in boxing history.
Roberto Duran, Luis Enriquez, Don King, the champion of the world. Roberto Duran.
Muchas gracias. Yo sabía que yo me lo ganaba. Yo soy más hombre que él.
Most people don't remember that one, though. By the way, did you watch any of these fights at all?
I did. I watched this one, and this was Sugar Ray's first loss, I believe, as a professional, right? And, you know, it really affected him as they had a rematch quickly. Nowadays, they fight like once every 3 years, it seems.
Every 3 years, yeah.
I did watch this fight, and... It was a great fight. I mean, I watched the whole thing.
It's a brilliant beginning to some of the great boxing. It's a great start for this decade of boxing.
It really is. It really is.
The rematch, as we mentioned, does take place pretty quickly, November 25th, 1980. So August, September, like four and a half months later, essentially.
Yeah.
This time, though, Sugar Ray Leonard looks a lot more like the Sugar Ray Leonard that people are used to seeing. He is faster. He is outboxing and he's outmaneuvering Durant the whole time. In the seventh round, people have probably seen this famous moment where Sugar Ray Leonard winds his right arm up as though he's going to punch and then throws a left hand out and hits Durant in the face, which is sort of an internet meme, I guess, now at this point. it's a great moment. What people mostly remember this fight, though, for is in the closing seconds of the eighth round, Roberto Duran, one of the toughest, roughest, meanest boxers of the 80s, turns his back to Sugar Ray Leonard, waving his glove casually and saying to the referee, "No mas, no more. I do not want any more of Sugar Ray Leonard." Leonard becomes the winner, regaining the welterweight title. He had a small margin at the time. I think it was just Durant knew what was coming. Durant was ready. He understood that he was outmatched.
Yeah, so I watched this as well, because which was fascinating. And by the way, I know you mentioned a podcast. What was it again? The podcast that you recommended?
Oh, Rummy's Corner, the YouTube channel.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm sorry. YouTube channel. Yeah. So I watched another YouTube channel which did a great job of breaking down pretty much all of the fights that the four kings fought together.
Yeah,
and that's. The Modern Martial Artist. Have you seen them?
Yeah, I've been on the Modern Martial Artist. Yeah, for sure.
Because that's another good one to check out because they break down the fight as it's happening. So it was fascinating for me as somebody who doesn't know much about boxing. But so, and I can give you my brief synopsis from what I learned.
Oh yeah, please, I love it. Yeah.
So Sugar Ray, I think he figured out Roberto Duran in the first fight. Too late.
Yeah.
Right?
Little too late.
And then he was devastated when he lost and he studied the fight and then figured out, okay, this is what I need to do. And Duran was great at going inside and fighting inside. Yeah. Right. He had really quick hands inside. And Sugar Ray had very fast hands to begin with. So he basically figure out how I need to go inside him. And I heard that Duran pretty much spent, because he went to Panama and was revered by the country after he beat Sugar Ray. So he was partying for like 4 months up until the second fight. And then he had to cut like 50 pounds before the fight. So he just wasn't ready.
I'm going to forget his name. I want to say it was Ruiz, Andy Ruiz. This happened not too long ago in the heavyweight division. There was this upstart contender who knocked out, I want to say it was, I'm going to screw both these names up. He knocked out like Anthony Joshua to win the title. He was like, they're calling him the Mexican Rocky. It's a real thing. Okay. His name is Ruiz. I'm going to forget about it. And then immediately went to Mexico and just partied for like 8 months. And when the rematch happened, he got smoked.
Yeah. And that's essentially what happened to Roberto Duran.
Joshua looks so tired. I think he wants out.
That's it. He says that's it. Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion. Michael Griffin was giving him every chance, but Joshua was looking to his corner. Did not advance. And Andy Ruiz has shocked the world. The Mexican Rocky indeed.
The Mexican Rocky makes me believe in movies now.
As much as I love these two characters, as much as they are two of the greatest boxers of the 80s, we are moving right past them. The only reason I want to bring them up is because their names will occasionally pop up here and there as opponents. But for the most part, we're focusing on our two key figures here, Tommy the Hitman Hearns and Marvelous Marvin Hagler. On August 2nd, 1980, Hearns got his hitman reputation, whacking a contender named Pepino Cuevas in two rounds to capture the WA welterweight belt. Hearns used his 6-inch reach advantage. He's got speed. That's the other thing when you watch Hearns. He's so long and lean. He's got that wiry muscle, and he just feels like he's always looming over the top of you. That reach is insane.
Yeah, he did. He towered over all of these guys because he was like 6'1" and they were like 5'9".
Yeah. Oh, man, Hearns. I love watching Hearns. He has this beautiful, like devastating right hand. He destroys Pepito Cuevas in these two rounds, which is also, it's not a great fight, but if you want to watch somebody get their ass kicked, it's pretty good. Hearns was the new WBA champion after this. We need to talk very briefly about something that's going to pop up here, and I'm just going to save you folks the trouble. Boxing weights are outrageous, and there's a million boxing belts. Just be aware that at this point, there are like four different titles, right? There's the WBA, there's the WBC, WBO, there's the lineal heavyweight title, which even trying to explain is hard to do. The point is, there's lots of different belts, and I don't want you to worry too much about them. Just be aware that people are winning lots of belts here.
And the weight classes, they're absurd.
Well, the weight class thing was interesting. I did a little research on this, and what I learned is that these weight classes that we sort of look at here are thought of as either glamorous or tweeners. The glamorous weights are the ones that are just straightforward. Heavyweight, middleweight, welterweight, right? The tweener ones are your light heavyweights, your super middleweights, your light middle welterweights, and all those kind of weird in-between titles, right? The only thing that's important to know about the weight classes and the belts is a lot of these guys are going to bounce up and down in different weight classes because you can drop and gain 5-6 pounds, no big deal if you're this kind of athlete. And a lot of these guys are going to be champions of multiple different weight classes with multiple different belts. It gets confusing. Just move it all out of your mind. Just know the belts are good and a lot of people are going to have them. That's all that matters. Let's talk about Marvin Hagler. Marvin Hagler is one of my favorite athletes of all time. He's so fascinating. He's so intimidating. Marvin Hagler, he's so big.
It's brutal.
Let me tell you a story about Marvin Hagler. Marvin Hagler spent the late 1970s known as boxing's most avoided fighter. So to try and get some fights, Hagler went to England in September of 1980. He destroyed a competitor named Adam Minter in just three rounds to become the undisputed middleweight champion. Again, don't worry about the belt. Don't worry about the weight class. One slight thing to know about this, which sort of ties into what we need to know about Marvin Hagler. This night in boxing, Hagler versus Minter in September 1980, is also known as British boxing's Night of Shame. There's a good article in The Guardian about this. Racial tensions between the two men are stirred pre-fight with comments from both camps. It had been claimed that Marvin Hagler had said, "I don't touch white flesh," although Hagler has refuted that this was anything he said. This was the quote from Hagler. "I make a point of never shaking hands with future opponents," he said, adding that he didn't feel it was appropriate to do so with someone he intended to inflict damage upon. And he also indicated that he always shook hands with his opponent after the fight. Mm-hmm. Whether or not Hagler said this is disputed. He says he didn't say it. Regardless, Minter hears this one way or the other, and he doesn't really help matters. He starts to take this to the next level, talking about the challenger. Yeah. Proclaiming that he's worked 17 years to get to the top and that, quote, he did not intend to lose his title to a black man, unquote. This, of course, gets its way back to Hagler. Hagler responds back. He will pay for saying this when we meet at Wembley Stadium. And pay he does. Oh, man, poor Alan Minter getting destroyed here. Alan Minter in three rounds receives 15 stitches for his troubles. As he wins, Hagler drops to his knees and raises his arm as he's celebrating. And then it becomes a riot. All hell breaks loose here. Disappointed at seeing the local English boy beaten and battered, combined with all of this unjustified rage toward the referee. They thought he stopped the fight too early. You have a full-blown riot at Wembley Stadium. Beer cans, bottles raining down from the crowd. Hagler is surrounded by his corner. They're all wrapped around him, is trying to protect him. With the help of the police, he's bundled out to safety. But all the people in the front row, like all the ringside commentators and all the rich folks, including television's Telly Savalas, they got nothing. They're getting hit with bottles left and right.
It's stopped in the third round, and Hagler's on his knees, acclaiming his victory. He said he was the rightful champion, and he's won it in three rounds, and people are throwing beer cans. And this is the worst scenes we've ever seen at Wembley in any boxing ring in this country. Minter smothered in blood. You can see from the towel the state he's in.
I give a lot of credit to Alan.
I mean, while that part with Telly Savalas makes me laugh, this is a very embarrassing moment for all of the British audience and the people in attendance. A wild moment in boxing history. The thing I want you to take away from this, though, is that Marvin Hagler is a man who backs up the things that he says. He's not the kind of guy you want to say idle things to or make angry, because he is a bad, bad dude.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's the one thing that the common theme, I think, amongst boxers, especially with these guys, probably all boxers, is, you know, the slightest hint of anything you say about them negative, they're going to use it against you and magnify it. And I think that makes sense. I mean, you see this in sports all the time with, you know, especially with Deion Sanders now. Everyone's like coming to his defense, or they're on the offensive and they're using bulletin board material. Michael Jordan was famous for this, any sort of slight. And maybe that's what it takes to be a high performing professional athlete. And that's why we're not. But boxers, I can see why you would need to do that, because you literally have to beat someone to a pulp, right?
No, I think you're 1,000% right. I've talked about this. I sort of jokingly said it after I watched The Last Dance. I was like, oh, now I get it. Michael Jordan is a sociopath. The only reason that, like, you can be this talented and be this good and be able to raise yourself to this level is you have to be absolutely behind everything that you do 1,000%. You have to be so irrationally confident in yourself that you will it into existence if you have to.
Bradford Smith, walking out of the gym, had said, "Nice game, Mike." And you knew that this wasn't going to go down well.
He's concentrating almost solely on the Bradford.
He took such umbrage at a guy saying, "Nice game, Mike," that he torched and humiliated him.
Oh, I hated him. And yeah, he carries even to this day. They made it personal.
It's insane. And that's why we are not professional athletes. You're 100% correct. Absolutely. Among a few other reasons. Height, weight, muscles, things like
that. Well, let's leave it at that, though.
You're taller than me, so that's good for you.
A quarter inch, maybe.
All right, let's do a little background here on Marvelous Marvin Hagler. You'll notice I keep calling him by his full name, Marvelous Marvin Hagler. So Marvelous Marvin Hagler is born on May 23rd, 1954, but his birth year publicly only came to light in 1982 because he had to go and state his date of birth at a court to legally change his name to Marvelous Marvin Hagler. That's right. It's not a nickname. His real name is Marvelous. And then his middle name, I guess, is Marvin now. And then Hagler's the last name.
So his name originally was just Marvin.
It was Marvin. Yeah, Marvin Nathan Hagler is his birth name. He changed it to Marvelous Marvin Nathan Hagler, I guess. And now you have an extra middle name. I don't know how it works. Either way, you sort of have to. He was very clear. He wanted you to know that he was Marvelous. He was very
absolutely. Why not?
One of the things we talked about is channeling. How do you channel that athlete, that inner athlete? How do you find that thing that makes you driven enough? And I think for Hagler, it's pretty easy. You look back at his life and career. Hagler is raised by his mother in the Central Ward of Newark, New Jersey, with five sisters and a half brother who also becomes a professional boxer. He starts boxing at the age of 10. For a social worker, he knew only as Mr. Joe. That was the guy who taught him, Mr. Joe. He taught him sports and got him involved in counseling other children. Hagler would then go on to drop out of school at the age of 14. He would work in a toy factory to support his family. But growing up, he always envisioned boxing for his future. He imagined himself along the lines of Floyd Patterson, who was his favorite boxer. Following the Newark riots in 1967, in which 26 people were killed and $11 million in property damages caused, including the destruction of the tenement that the Haglers lived in, the Hagler family would move to Boston, Massachusetts, which is where he sort of calls home today, or during the 80s. That's where he's fighting out of Boston, Massachusetts. Sure. Brockton, Massachusetts. I have to be sure not to say Boston. That's not true. Brockton, Massachusetts.
For 5 days, it was a battleground and a looter's paradise. Colored citizens clashed with police, National Guardsmen, and state troopers. 24 people were killed and 1,200 injured. Nearly half the city was in the grip of terror. The Newark flare-up sparked similar riots in other American centers, with hatred near danger point between white and black extremist groups. In Newark, there was an uneasy tension, punctuated by minor outbreaks of violence after 5 days of bloody fighting.
Very quick, Mr. Famo's History Corner. For whatever reason this week, I watched, again, the Sopranos prequel movie. I watched it for the second time. It's still not good, mind you. I thought maybe this time it would be better. It's not. But it's interesting because of the Newark riots plays like a pretty big part in that.
Yeah.
Movie and in like the backstory of all these characters. So I thought it was funny when I was doing this. I was like, oh, Newark, it's back. So for folks who don't know, the Newark riots or the Newark uprising began on July 12th when a black cab driver was beaten by two white police officers for a minor traffic offense. 5 days of rioting and looting that followed produced 26 deaths, 700 injuries, and more than 1,400 arrests. National Guard and state troopers were called in to restore order. This is a quote from the New York Times. To some, the flames and violence were riots, wrecking neighborhoods and driving away middle-class residents. Or was it rebellion, the uprising of a long-oppressed community that had finally had enough? Newark riots are a super important part of American history and civil rights history. I don't want to go any farther into that. It's a much longer story. I think it's just important. Sure. I think it's super important to know, though, that these riots certainly tie into the hard life that the Hagler family and Marvin himself have in this time as he's becoming a young boxer.
From rooftops and windows, snipers pick their targets. The toll of dead and injured tells its own tragic story. Damage runs into millions of dollars. With the coming of the long, hot summers, for 3 years, America has had to face the tragic consequences of riots stemming from the slums of cities stretching right across the nation.
You mean Marvelous, but okay.
Oh, that's right, Marvelous. That's right. Yeah. Hagler talks about this. He says he looked down at the street at the looters, and it was almost like watching ants on a picnic table. He described the riots as really horrifying, and nobody left the Hagler apartment for 3 days. Once the riot's over, the neighborhood is mostly in ruins, and many of the cars are stripped. After another riot, his family, again, of course, gets out of Newark and moves to Brockton, Massachusetts. 1969, Hagler begins boxing after being in a street fight with a local boxer with his friends watching. So the day after the fight, Hagler had was determined that, you know what, I'm going to become a boxer. So he walks into a gym owned by these brothers, Pat and Goody Petronelli. I always love a good Italian boxing coach. Always wanted one of my own. they become his trainers and his managers. As Hagler needed to be 16 in order to enter amateur tournaments, he lied about his age, saying that he was born in 1952 instead of 1954. This is why, when we began the story, he had to admit the age change when he changed his name. Sure. That was the first time he was forced to. In May of 1973, Hagler won the National Amateur Athletic Union 65-pound title after defeating Terry Dobbs. He would turn pro with an amateur career of 55-1. Very impressive.
Absolutely.
We can sort of skip past some of the other stuff here, but we'll go back to the... So after beating Alan Minter, like we said, in 1980 and Britain's Great Night of Shame, Hagler proved to be a busy world champion after winning the title for the next few years. He has big money fights against Roberto Duran in November of 1983. Duran is actually the first challenger to last the distance with Hagler in a world championship bout. When they fought on November 10th, Duran is the WBA light middleweight championship. He had gone up in weight to challenge Hagler for the middleweight crown. Hagler wins in a 15-round unanimous decision, although after 13 rounds, many folks felt that Duran was ahead on points. Hagler came out strong with a swollen and cut eye in the last two rounds, a very heroic performance to come back and win that fight and defend the title. But again, another appearance from Roberto Duran. Show his face one more time here in 1980.
Absolutely.
To the head of Roberto Duran.
20-odd seconds to go in the fight. Left hand by, he rocks Hagler with the right hand. Hagler with the left as we head for the belt.
For the winner by unanimous decision, and still the undisputed middleweight champion of the world, Marvelous Marvin Hagler.
Let's move away for just a moment from Marvelous Marvin. Let's talk about our other protagonist here. I don't know that you're allowed to have two nicknames. I think that's unfair. I think a lot of these guys have great nicknames. I just want to bring that out before I mention that not only does Tommy Hearns have one cool nickname as Thomas the Hitman Hearns, his secondary nickname is the Motor City Cobra. Let's think about that for just one second. The Motor City Cobra.
Yeah.
Tommy the Hitman Hearns. Unreal.
You're right. If you're going to have two, they can't both be awesome.
No, one's got to stink. How do you get
one's
got to
stink? You can't have two awesome nicknames.
Did you ever have a nickname growing up?
No, I never had a nickname growing up. There's nothing about my name that is nicknameable, I guess. I'm sure you've been Famo most your life.
That's true. Famo's pretty easy. That's a Famo one. I will tell you one that I got that wasn't like name-based, though. When I was a kid and I was in my punk rock bands and I was like 15 and shit, we were, you know, trying to write songs for the first time, all our first little punk rock songs. And I would always come in and write like, hey guys, I got this song, blah, blah, blah. And I'd play the song. And, you know, inevitably someone in the band would be like, that's a Green Day song. You didn't write that. That's just, you know, I'm like, oh, I see. Right. You know? So for years, my buddy Pat would call me the Rip Dog because I was always ripping off songs. So for a couple years, I was the Rip Dog, Sam Familaro. That's that one sort of phased out because it became less cool as time went on. I was like, no more of that. But yeah, that was the only nickname I ever earned through some nonsense, through some bullshit that I was doing.
Got it. Yep.
Anyway, Thomas the Hitman Hearns, born in Grand Junction, Tennessee, 1958, the youngest of three children in his mother's first marriage. With his second marriage, six more children joined the first three. So now we're talking a real big family. On her own, by the way, Mrs. Hearns raises Tommy and his siblings until Tommy is 5 years old. Family will then move to Detroit, Michigan, thus the Motor City Cobra. Much like Hagler, Hearns has a stellar amateur career. He's 155-8, and also like Hagler, he goes on to win the National Amateur Athletic Union Light Welterweight Championship in 1977. He also wins the 1977 National Gold Gloves Light Heavyweight Championship. So again, a very accomplished amateur boxer before making his way into the professional career. Speaking of which, he begins his career, of course, in Detroit, Michigan, under the tutelage of a guy named Emmanuel Stewart. Stewart had changed Hearns from a light hitting boxer into becoming one of the more devastating punchers in boxing history. I always hate to jump out of a good part of the story to talk about something else. But for people who've never heard of this guy, Emanuel Stewart is maybe the most underappreciated boxing trainer in the world. Like, he has trained some of the greatest boxers you've heard of, all of the great fighters. He doesn't get enough credit. I'll just give you a quick rundown of a few names for boxing fans out there. Julio Cesar Chavez, Miguel Cotto, Oscar De La Hoya, Tyson Fury, Thomas Hearns, Evander Holyfield, Vladimir Klitschko, Lennox Lewis, Oliver McCall, who else? Michael Moore, former heavyweight champion, Aaron Pryor, who is a dude who deserves his own episode of this show, James Tunney, again, top boxers over the last 20, 30 years. Emanuel Stewart, what a legend. Emanuel Stewart, again, he's the one who really kicks on Hearns in his career, and Hearns starts his career by knocking out his first 17 opponents in 1980. As we discussed earlier, he carries a 28-0 record into a world title fight against Mexico's Pepino Chavez. Oh, Cuevas, he's back. He got beat up by Hagler, and now he's about to get beat up by Hearns. What a shame for Pepino Cuevas. Oh, poor guy. Hearns ends Cuevas' four-year reign by beating him a TKO in the second round. Hearns was voted Fighter of the Year by Ring Magazine in 1980. If it seems weird that Ring Magazine has something to say in it, Ring Magazine is weirdly important in boxing. You wouldn't think that a magazine would be so popular and important, but it really was. It's kind of surprising.
Yeah.
1981, we get one of these big-time fights. We got another one. We had Duran Hagler. Now we're bringing back our buddy, Sugar Ray Leonard. Hearns, the WBA champion, 32-0, will fight the WBC champion, Sugar Ray Leonard, who is 30-1, in hopes of unifying the welterweight championship in a bout simply known as the showdown. In this fight, Tommy Hearns suffers his first professional defeat when Ray Leonard stops him in the 14th round. In the 13th round, Leonard was behind on points in all three judges' scorecards and was essentially told, you need a knockout to win. He comes on strong. He puts Hearns through the ropes at the end of the round, knocks him out of the ring.
Leonard knows he has him. Now Hearns is fighting back. Hearns away now.
Oh, what a hook by Hearns right on
that
the button.
Hurt. Leonard keeps coming on. He's a bull. Leonard takes the better punch.
19 seconds to go. Can he weather it?
Hearns is dazed. He's totally out of gas. He receives a count, but he's saved by the bell at the end of the round. He probably would not have survived. Yeah. Leonard, with his left eye shut and the time running out, resumes in the 14th. Hearns starts the round boxing and moving, but he gets staggered. Leonard pins Hearns against the ropes. Another combination. Bing, bang, boom. It's all over. Leonard makes the comeback. Leonard, this is one of the most important, biggest fights in boxing history. Referee Davey Paul stops the fight after just an awful, awful beatdown. Hearns and Leonard bank $17 million for this fight. $17 million, which in 1981 is probably pretty slick.
Oh, yeah. For sure. For sure.
The only thing that's important to know about this fight, yes, Tommy Hearns loses. Yes, he loses by referee stoppage in a fight that it felt like he was about to win. But this fight is also the last fight that Sugar Ray Leonard will fight until 1989, because during the fight, he suffers a detached retina at the hands of Thomas the Hitman Hearns. Sugar Ray Leonard is probably the best of these four boxers, quote unquote, if you're ranking them. To me, he's also the one that there's a million things about, and I'm not really super interested in. So I feel bad saying it.
Well, no, I think you're right, because I think he beat all of them. Right?
He did beat all of them. Yeah. He was the real winner, I guess, at the end of all of this.
Yeah. And he was, you know, yeah, Sugar Ray was the most famous of the group while they were all famous too. I mean, he was famous before he was even a champion because he won in the Olympics.
Yeah, that's right. It's true.
Yeah, yeah. But we don't want to get too far into Sugar Ray, right? But
I reserve the right to do an episode later on, but go ahead. Yeah.
Because I'm amazed that he's the one that you would think wouldn't be the best, but he was such a good boxer, right?
Technique.
So smart and technique. Yeah. Just it was interesting to watch.
It's not too dissimilar from like Floyd Mayweather and Pacquiao. Like Mayweather is the better boxer. He's super technical, but I would much rather watch a Manny Pacquiao fight any day of the week.
Yeah.
It's just a better watch. Yeah.
Right.
So real quick, Tommy Hearns, after that fight with Sugar Ray Leonard, moves up in weight. He wins the WBC super welterweight title from boxing legend, three-time world champion Wilfred Benitez, who at the time was 41-1-1 in New Orleans in 1982. During his reign at that title, he destroys Roberto Hands of Stone Duran. He becomes the first boxer to knock out Roberto Duran. This is Tommy Hearns's pinnacle achievement. This earns him his second in a row Fighter of the Year from Ring Magazine.
Duran just fighting on instinct, O'Gill. He's just hanging a big right hand. That's it,
Tim. The fight's over, Tim.
A huge right hand by Thomas Hearns right to the cheekbone of Roberto Duran, and it is all over. A second round knockout for the hitman, Thomas Hearns, who said he would knock out Duran in two, and he did just that.
I think it's important, right? Hagler and Duran, that fight goes all the way to the distance. Duran gives Hagler everything he can handle.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Hearns embarrasses Roberto Duran.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
it's tough. And I just want to make a point here before we get to the actual fight itself. We got to talk about something that doesn't happen anymore. And this is why I think boxing has suffered in the years. I mentioned before, there's that video of the 1990s heavyweights of all the different heavyweight fights that happened from the beginning of the 90s to the end. And so many great names, so many legends. Same here at the 1980s. What a concept. All of the top fighters fight each other and have great fights instead of avoiding each other so that they can pad out their record. It's been, I know that's like the super coldest take in the history of the planet, but when you watch these fights, it's just so frustrating that these guys, that you don't have this anymore. That there's, and again, maybe it's just that there's not as many good guys anymore. Boxing has been depleted by the rise of like MMA and other sports, I think, but I don't know, man. It just feels like we're missing out on so many great fights because they don't want that one in the loss column.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you bring that up because I was thinking about this quite a bit while doing some research for the podcast, is why isn't boxing as popular as it was in the 80s and 90s? At least I don't think it is, right?
It's not.
It's certainly not in my consciousness most of the time. And you're right, it's probably a lot to do with the MMA and other contact sports. And I think athletes might be going in to different directions as well, not just to those, the combat sports, but even probably some of the WWE stuff. It's like, well, why can't I can go do this and not, you know, give my, well, you're still going to get beat up a little bit, but you know, you're not going to get destroyed.
As a guy who likes boxing, I've thought about this a lot. So with professional wrestling, if I go see a wrestling show live, or I watch wrestling on TV, it's a 2-hour show. I know that the entire 2 hours will be filled with content. There'll be some good content, some bad content. There'll be matches. There'll be a story. There'll be something that happens. It will fill the whole time, right? If you go to an MMA fight or you watch an MMA fight, that you're just watching is like it's immediate. It's like TikTok and social media. It's fast. Yeah. The rounds are shorter. It's better for social media. It plays better in other places. Boxing, even today, is still 15 rounds, long fights. No one's really a star anymore. And not for nothing, and I hate to say it, who's the biggest star in boxing right now? It's probably Jake Paul. You know what I mean? It's probably, I'm not even, like, those fights get money. People watch those fights. People would rather watch Jake Paul fight former NBA legend Nate Robinson than they would watch Tyson Fury fight a guy who's not the number one contender for right. his title. Why do I want to watch Tyson Fury, who is a great boxer, by the way, fight the seventh ranked heavyweight because he knows he's going to win? What the hell? I don't want to watch that.
Yeah, no, you've got, yeah, you're right. It's, there's, and while Tyson Fury's a great boxer, he's not as big of a name. And, you know, the thing about Tyson Fury is that it's, for me, it's just bizarre because he's just a 6'9 dude with a dad bod. But yet he's a really good boxer. And these guys that, you know, they were little, right? I mean, 5'9 to 6'1, but yeah. they were, I mean, tough as nails. I mean, look at them. It's like, well, you wouldn't want to mess with them. Not that I want to mess with Tyson Fury because he's huge, but it's just, there's aesthetically, it's Tyson Fury is not bringing it.
Well, for some context, the fight we're about to talk about, the big fight, is a welterweight title fight. I want to say, I got to look back here. I'm going to feel bad if I get it wrong, but if it's welterweight, you're talking, these guys are between 147 and 140 pounds.
Yeah.
They're not giants. They are just ripped to the bone and absolutely shredded because that's exactly. all they do is punch bags all day.
That's Wilder wobbling. Oh, good
uppercut by Fury.
Right hand by Fury as well. Wilder somehow staying on his feet. Taking supernatural strength.
Fury throwing that uppercut again.
Russell Moura waves it off. He's not counting. The Gypsy King is the heavyweight champion of the world.
I got to do a quick mild self-edit, okay? So when Hearns defeats Wilfred Benitez, he wins the welterweight title, which is about 147 pounds, so a little more than that, okay?
Okay.
When Hagler and Hearns decides, when we decide that Hagler and Hearns is coming, when this is the booked fight, Hearns has to move up from welterweight to junior middleweight and then to middleweight, which means he's jumping from 147 to 160. That's a pretty, you know, 13 pounds isn't nothing to scoff at. It's not easy to add that kind of weight quickly.
No, it's not. Absolutely.
Not in a healthy way. I mean, I could do it with like cheeseburgers, but I mean like as a professional athlete.
Well, what was the time frame? Do we know?
It's a good question here. So he fights that fight in December of 82. This fight is in April of 83. So January, February, March, April. So about 4 months to add on 13 pounds, presumably of muscle, to get to 160.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess you could do it. Yeah, I guess it's not undoable. I suppose that's all right. Even with this weight disparity, though, this pair's got like a history. People know them as these powerful punchers. And the way that they won their fights coming into this with Duran getting destroyed and Hagler being this dominant defensive champion. People are excited about this fight and it's gaining interest around the world. The fight is held at Caesars Palace, Las Vegas, Nevada on April 15th, 1985. It's broadcast in most places on HBO with Barry Tompkins, Larry Merchant, one of my favorite boxing commentators of all time, and Sugar Ray Leonard calling commentary. What a sneaky move for Sugar Ray, getting himself in there. Always got to get his grandstanding in. If you're listening in at Top Rank for England, so if you're watching from there, it would have been Al Michaels and Al Bernstein on the call. Interesting side note, no one knows if it changed anything. Despite his trainer, Emmanuel Stewart, telling him not to, Tommy Hearns received a massage.
Yeah.
Fight. I don't know what that does, but Stewart didn't seem happy about it.
No, he was not.
Stewart said he felt the massage weakened Hearns' legs during the fight and led to him to adopting the more aggressive approach than he normally would have taken in a fight like this. Randall, I got to ask you, had you seen this fight before we talked about it for this week?
No, I had not.
So we're going to get into the round by round.
Yep.
I'm going to talk about the first round. I'm going to talk about the first round here, but after the first round, I want to get your thoughts about what you thought watching this fight for the first time. So,
okay. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. As the first round starts, Marvin Hagler, normally a slow starter, storms Tommy Hearns from the opening bell. He is out from the gate. Several big, giant right hands pins Hearns against the ropes. Hearns throws that devastating right hand, and it hits Hagler right on the chin, stunning Hagler for a moment before he's able to tie him up in the clinch. A few seconds later, though, once they break up that clinch, they're back at it. Power punches back and forth. Hagler's trying to go inside, pinning Hearns against the ropes. In the process, though, he succeeds in hitting Hearns with a hard left hand. Hearns ties up Hagler again and tries to slow the pace by boxing rather than doing this power punching nonsense, just throwing haymakers. But that lasts for only a moment before these two once again start to throw power punches. The important fact here, when Hearns throws that left hand and he hits Hagler, he breaks his hand. I'm sorry, it's his right hand. He throws that right hand. He hits Hagler and he breaks his hand in the first round. So he's going to fight the rest of this fight with a broken right hand. This goes on for the better part of 2.5 minutes. They're both trading heavy blows. There is no defense. There is no pacing. They are not stopping or slowing down at all. Hagler gets a cut on his forehead, but he's just plowing right through it. He pins Hearns to the ropes. He's throwing more punches, hurting Hearns at the end of the round. As the bell rings, sportscaster Barry Tompkins, who's doing blow-by-blow for the HBO fight, yells, "This is still only the first round." Al Bernstein on Top Rank said, "Perhaps one of the best opening rounds in middleweight history."
Tremendous pace in the first round. Blood coming from the face of Marvin Hagler. Can't tell yet where it's coming from. We'll see.
Both guys will definitely be winded in the next round.
It is over the right eye, I believe, of Marvin Hagler. We'll wait till we get him. And there's a lot of blood early on here. An awful lot of blood on the face of Marvin Hagler. It isn't a place where it could do serious damage.
Ring Magazine would later go on to say that this may be the greatest round in boxing history, later won round of the year in 1985. Ray, what were your thoughts on round one of one of the greatest slugfests in boxing history?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun to watch. It was like watching a movie because it's all action. I mean, it wasn't, you know, they weren't dancing around the ring. They were just going at it. And for someone who doesn't watch a lot of boxing, when I do tune in, it seems to be a lot of downtime in the middle of a round. You're like, aren't they supposed to be fighting? But yeah, this was exactly what you want boxing to be.
Yeah.
Right.
How many times did you watch like a Rocky movie when you were an adult and think to yourself, you know, that's not what they would have stopped this fight already. There's no way that this match would keep going on. Like, real boxing would never look like this. This is about as close as real boxing has ever been to looking like a Rocky movie.
Yeah. No, you're right about that because, you know, I grew up in the Rocky era. I mean, that was, I was, you know, in the early 80s, all those Rocky movies, I went to the theater to see them.
Yeah.
So it doesn't translate from the movie theater to going home and watching a fight because they didn't look like Rocky. Right.
Yeah, this looks like Rocky. It feels like Rocky.
It does.
And I always think to myself, like, I'm of two minds. If all boxing was like this, people would watch boxing all the time. But if all boxing was like this, many boxers would die at an early age because this is like unsustainable violence. What's going on here? It's brutal.
The second round, these guys would definitely pace themselves. There has been no boxing at all. Just fighting here.
Just slugging. Blood on the face of Marvin Hagler. Again, we can't quite tell where it's coming from while Hagler continues to dish out punishment. And now Hearns bounces right back. This may be the most brutal even round you've ever seen in boxing.
And just by proxy, when the second round starts, it does sort of slow down. These guys do have a bit of a come down here in the second round. By the beginning of the second, it looks as though Hearns has no legs under him. He's slowing the pace. He stumbles 7 times as he's attempting to move around the ring. You see this sometimes in boxing when a guy takes a hit like late in the first round. The second round starts and they're not ready yet. It's like, no,
yeah,
I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm dancing around. I'm moving. You just got to buy a little more time. He's stumbling. He's trying to change position. Sugar Ray Leonard, who can't help but get his call in. "I don't like the way Tommy's moving. A little rubbery legged." "Oh, yeah? You think, Ray? Thanks a lot. Thanks, Ray."
Round sort of the way people anticipated the first round might go.
another right hand stuns Hearns. The crowd, of course, emphatic over every punch that's thrown. Hagler, despite that recent disadvantage, has been able to get into Hearns more so than I think most people expected.
For one simple reason, good left hook by Hagler. He took the best Hearns could offer, and he did come in. He's getting through that right hand, even though he's getting hit with it.
In the studio broadcast of the fight later on, Hearns would comment, "My legs were gone, man. Even before I came out to fight, my legs felt weak." Again, we shouldn't have gotten that massage.
That massage.
Hagler experimented by switching to the orthodox style and then switching back to southpaw. For folks that don't know what that means, essentially switching your lead boxing hand from your left hand to your right hand and back and forth to confuse your opponent.
Hagler has fought most of this round as a righty. Now he switches southpaw and lands. Not as effective as a righty as I thought, but now it's a southpaw. The jab lands well.
And he finds more success going back to southpaw, countering the jab. By the end of the round, Hagler is again pinned Hearns against the ropes. He's landing a volley of punches. And while it does slow from the blistering pace, it's still a great fight compared to most boxing matches.
Inside, now up top, half a minute to go in round two.
Oh, what a left.
Hearns trading with him. Hagler comes back to the right, a left, and another right. He has Hearns in trouble on the ropes. Tommy trying to punch his way off the ropes. Hagler wants to keep him there, goes to the body.
Hagler throws low blows. Marvin Hagler wants to turn this into an alley war, and he's done it. Another low blow. Richard Steele may take points away soon, but will it matter?
Second round coming to an end. Hagler bloody, but very much unbound.
The judges at this point are pretty split. You have two judges after two rounds who have it 10-9 for Hagler, and one judge who has it 10-9 for Hearns. So it's a bit back and forth. Some would say that Hearns won the second round. Most guys think it, you know, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah, I think at the end of the second round, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Sam.
Yeah.
Hagler did. He got a bunch of hits in right at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But yeah. But Hearns walked back to his corner kind of smiling, acting like it didn't bother him.
Yes, that's right. Classic classic move. Just like show your opponent. No, I'm good.
Yeah. I'm fine.
Also, something I've noticed from years of watching boxing. You know, those last like 10 seconds of the round are super important because you can sway the decision on a round that's going one way or the other. If it's a medium round, if you can sneak a couple, even if they're not good punches, but if you can show some action, you might be able to sneak that point out at the end of that round from a sympathetic judge who sees that.
Yeah, I think actually Sugar Ray was he was often accused of that. Trying to win the round at the end.
Floyd Mayweather, another legend for doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's get into the final round here. Round three. Tommy Hearns, again, now that he's had a round under his legs, he's trying once again to set the pace. About a minute into the round, that cut on Marvin Hagler's forehead from the first round is opening back up. And now you're starting to get lots of blood flow down the champion's face.
Mm-hmm.
The referee, famed boxing referee Richard Steele, halts the action to have the ringside physician come in and examine Hagler.
When Marvin gets him in the corner, he is roughhousing him well.
Again, Hagler is all bloodied. Time is called by Richard Steele to send Hagler over to the ring doctor. He's calling the ring doctor in. The last thing in the world Hagler wants is the fight to be stopped. The doctor looks at it. Back comes Hagler with a wild left hand. It has to be impeding his vision with the right eye. You never know it, though. Tremendous right.
He informs Steele, this cut's not bothering his sight. You can let him go.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, Hagler understands that he is on a time limit.
Yeah,
if this cut gets worse, he's going to get ref stoppaged and he's going to lose this fight. So now Hagler's back at it. He's got to win this fight and he has to win it now. A tremendous overhand left to the head hits Hearns and drives him back to the ropes. It dizzies him. This is my favorite part of the fight. Hearns backs away. He's smiling as to suggest that this punch has not hurt him. Hagler lands a right hook high on Hearns' head. This staggers Hearns, and he starts stumbling backwards towards the ropes, looking for anything.
Another right hand. Hearns turns his back, takes another right. Hearns in deep trouble again. Hearns is down. Hearns is down in the third round and on his back, and he's not going to beat the count. I don't believe. Tommy Hearns tries to get up, and
they've got to stop this fight.
Does he get up? He just does not. He can't continue. It's Hagler, full of blood.
Hagler comes running after him. Hot pursuit. Vicious right hand. Smashes Hearns right in the face. Hearns goes limp. He falls forward and bam, Hagler, two big uppercuts. Hearns falls down onto the canvas. And again, Sugar Ray, he's back out of nowhere. He yells into the microphone. He's gone. He's gone. And gone. he was, but only sort of. You got to give Hearns credit here. Hearns gets up. He doesn't stay down. One of the toughest guys you'll ever see. He staggers to his feet at the count of nine. But even then, the referee decides that he has seen enough. Richard Steele stops the bout and holds Hearns upright. The image of a blood-soaked Hagler carried around the ring by his handlers and Hearns being carried back to his corner in semi-consciousness is sort of the image of this match that we
Absolutely.
See.
Absolutely.
Hearns on the shoulders. Oh, sorry. Hagler on the shoulders. Hearns in the corner. It's quite a sight. It's a really jar. It's a very cinematic, again, going back to the Rocky thing.
It really is. It's like here you have this warrior coming into the ring to fight, and then he's literally being carried out.
Marvelous Marvin Hagler. So close to being knocked out in the first round. Withstood the barrage. You'd have to figure he lost round one, came back round two, despite the deep cut time call by Richard Steele in round three. Ring doctor observes, comes back, knocks him out in round three.
Yeah.
In someone's arms. You know, the whole juxtaposition of the visual is just absurd to watch. But it was cool.
This is the pinnacle for me of boxing when I think about it. Like, I just love everything about this fight. And things get weird for Marvin Hagler a little bit after this, and also kind of for Tommy Hearns. But for me, like when I think about like the great periods of boxing, I, in my mind, even though it was before my era, I've done my research. I feel like this middleweight era from the 80s into mm-hmm. that heavyweight era of the 90s, that's about as good as boxing was ever going to get for me personally. That was my era when I think about the great legends, you know?
Okay.
But boxing, much like a lot of the things we talk about here, has a huge deep history. That's the other thing with boxing.
Yeah,
goes
sure.
so far back.
Shaking off some thunderous blows in round one. Withstanding the barrage, suffering the cut, coming back strong in round two, finishing them in round three. Hearns right above us in the corner. Tommy still shaking. Tommy on his stool. And Tommy, of course, very disappointed and frustrated as Marvin Hagler, marvelous Marvin Hagler, the legal name, retains the undisputed.
Let's talk about the aftermath of this fight. This is, of course, for Hagler, this is the pinnacle. This is the highlight of his career. This cements his legacy as one of the greatest middleweight boxers of all time. In the immediate aftermath, Donald Curry, he's working on British television. He's highly critical of Tommy Hearns. He says, Tommy fought the wrong fight. He should have started cautiously. Don't get into a dogfight. That's what he did, and he lost. British newspapers called this 8 minutes of mayhem. The Ring called the most electrifying 8 minutes ever. One fight of the year in 1987, despite only being three rounds long.
Yeah.
I found a really beautiful Sports Illustrated list of the greatest boxing fights of all time. And they listed this at number six, greatest boxing match of all time. Would you like to know the other five?
Yeah, I'm curious.
So going all the way back, number five, 1923, this is Jack Dempsey and Louis Firpo. So we're talking, you know, old school here, you know, Jack Dempsey knockout second round. Number four is Aaron Pryor versus Alexis Arguello. I think it's Argueo. Aaron Pryor is a guy who's under talked about. Maybe down the road, I'll do something on Aaron Pryor, but this is not one that I don't remember. Number three, of course, Joe Frazier versus Muhammad Ali, Madison Square Garden, March 8th, 1971. Number two, Sugar Ray Leonard versus Tommy Hearns, September 16th, 1981. And then the number one of all time in Manila, in the Philippines, October 1st, 1975, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, the Thrilla in Manila. Yeah,
sure.
Again, it's hard to think about boxing because we've talked about 1975 all the way back to 1923. So we're talking about a lot of fights here. Let's did you have any extra thoughts about this? I want to look at some of the longer term stuff, but anything else stick to your mind before we move on to that?
Well, I think that with this fight and with Hagler in particular, since he was they said he was a switch hitter, basically he was he was just as good with his left or his right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was almost ambidextrous in the ring where he could fight either way.
Yeah.
And that, I think, really, I mean, that helps him all the time. Right. And it helped him become a champion. And I really believe that Hearns is breaking his hand in the first round. Now, he didn't want to even say anything initially. He didn't want to take away from Hagler, right?
Yeah.
When the fight was over.
Yeah.
But I mean, that had to have played a big part because he was known for that powerful right hand.
Yeah. And it's a shame too, because it's one of those great sliding doors moments where I wonder what this fight would have been with the non-broken hand, right? Would Hearns have fought differently? And what if he didn't get that massage? Man, that massage. I keep thinking about it afterwards.
That massage.
We don't have to spend too much time about like the legacy here. We've talked about it again. Solidifies Hagler as one of the best middleweights. And for Hearns, it just solidifies him as one of the toughest and most skilled boxers of the era. Like, even in the loss, people are like, yup, this dude's a bad dude.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened after this. In what could in itself be its own sort of separate episode, Hagler would fight one of the most controversial fights in boxing history against Sugar Ray Leonard, which would end in a split decision in 1987. Hagler started that fight abandoning his usual stance in favor of an orthodox stance.
Yep.
This would prove costly. He loses two rounds early on. By round three, he switches back. He spends most of the fight as the aggressor. And Leonard, as we mentioned, he's just going to pepper Hagler with combinations and run away. I've already won three rounds. I'm just going to hit you to death, and we're going to round you away, and I'm going to win this thing in rounds.
Yeah.
Leonard is fighting left. Tim, he's looking to nail Hagler. Got nailed himself that time with that right hook. Hagler's still cocking. Leonard would hope it's in frustration. Hagler's starting to get the range a little bit now, though, Tim. Yes. And he got him in the corner, landed to the left. And like it's just starting to get the range. The conditioning of these two athletes is extraordinary. Hagler's solid right by Hagler.
Leonard would attack Hagler with a fury of punches. He's going to steal the rounds at the end. We talked a little bit about this earlier. Overall, Leonard's landing a lot more punches compared to Hagler. He's landing at a higher percentage, too, which is a big part of it. You know, percentage
absolutely.
Is a big... Yeah. Two judges had the fight close with 7-5 each way. One of the judges, Lou Filippo... Filippo is scoring the fight 115-113 for Hagler, 115-113. But then one of the judges has it totally lopsided at 118-110, with Leonard winning 10 rounds and Hagler only winning two. This scorecard is derided by the media. People are like, this is outrageous. Guerra later acknowledges he made a mistake and should have scored at least two more rounds for Hagler. But after this is where Hagler's story gets interesting to me. Because this is my favorite part of anyone's career, actually, their Italian film career. After this loss, Hagler decides he's done with boxing for a little bit, and he moves to Italy, where he becomes a well-known star of Italian action films, including playing a U.S. Marine in the films Indio and its sequel Indio 2 in 89 and 91. And then in 1997, he stars alongside Terrence Hill and Giselle Blondet in Virtual Weapon.
Hey, you still have the same car.
Yeah. Yeah. Because for 7 years, 3 months, and 1 week, no one shot at me. In other words, since the day you left.
Don't worry, Mike. I'm a new man. No more cowboy stuff for me.
Hagler also provided boxing commentary for British TV. He also started working with the video game Fight Night Round 3. I actually remember that. In March 13th of 2021, Hagler's wife, Kay, announced that he had died of natural causes at his home in New Hampshire at the age of 66. His son, James, said his father was taken to the New Hampshire hospital after experiencing chest pains and difficulty breathing. Again, inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1993. One of the all-time greats. I just think... And for me, when I think about guys like Hagler, I see him, and I could be wrong here. Some real boxing professional might correct me. I see him in the lineage of guys like Tyson and guys like Sonny Liston before him. Just the presence, the persona goes a long way, that it scares you before you even get in the ring sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. He was, absolutely. Very fearsome. I wouldn't even want to go near a ring with him in it.
It's got to be, I think about it sometimes, when I watch, like, I used to watch, like, professional wrestling with Brock Lesnar when he was in the UFC as well. Like, Brock Lesnar, like, you see that guy across the ring, and you just start thinking, you have to just think to yourself, like, well, I'm going to lose, right? Like, this guy's going to beat me, right? Like, what am I supposed to, it doesn't matter what I do. Look at him. He's a freak, right?
Yeah.
Tommy Hearns would continue boxing. In March of 1987, Hearns scored 6 knockdowns in a fight against Dennis Ardenes to win the WBC light heavyweight title with a 10th round stoppage. Later that year, his 4-round destruction of Juan Roldan, he would claim the vacant WBC middleweight title, making him a 4-weight world champion. That's kind of a rare thing to happen in boxing.
Hearns is trying to throw the uppercut.
Landed the right hand. Down goes Roldan. He's not going to get up. This one is over. Thomas Hearns has made boxing history. And there it is again.
He just walked right into it.
Well, you know, Roldan never doesn't pace himself. It's either you or him. He just lets it all.
This is kind of a weird side note for all you Giants fans out there. In a huge upset, Tommy Hearns lost that WBC middleweight title to Iran Barkley via a 3rd-round TKO in June of 1988. The 1988 Ring Magazine upset of the year. If you don't know who Iran Barkley is, of course you don't. But you know his son. It's New York Giants running back Saquon Barkley. That's right. It's Saquon's dad.
Really? Yeah, I didn't know that was Saquon's dad.
That's
very
right.
Interesting.
Yeah, Saquon's dad knocked out Tommy Hearns in 1989.
No way. Not this time. We created it. Not this time. No. Not this time. It's totally made up. Pure fiction.
Tommy Hearns would get his long-awaited rematch with Sugar Ray Leonard, although he had to wait until 1989 for it. This time it was for Sugar Ray Leonard's super middleweight title and for Hearns' WBO title. This was Hearns' 6th super fight, a fight which much of the public believed that Hearns won as he floored Leonard in both the 3rd and 11th rounds. However, the judges scored the fight a controversial draw.
Yeah,
what
a draw.
I'm not saying that Sugar Ray Leonard received favorable treatment. He's one of the greatest boxers of all time. I am just telling people that boxing is one of the most openly corrupt sports in all of professional sports. So if you think if you think a fight's rigged, there's not rigged, but if you think the judging is rigged or the scorecard is weird, it probably is.
Yeah, which could also play into why it's not as popular. We didn't even factor that in earlier.
Well, no, because FIFA is super corrupt and people still love soccer. I think it's just, do you know what I mean? Like, in the Olympics are super corrupt and all these big giant things are super corrupt with how they do business, but no one seems to care.
Sam, you're
going to
ruin everything by pointing that out. So everything's corrupt. I'm sorry.
All things, yeah, all things in this, of course, are corrupt. All the things we love, at least. So, sorry, it's awful. So let's get back to Tommy Hearns, because there is some fun stuff here at the end for Tommy Hearns. Tommy Hearns had one last great performance in boxing in 1991 as he challenged undefeated WBA light heavyweight champion Virgil Hill. In Hill's 11th defense of the title, Tommy Hearns returned to his amateur roots and outboxed the champion to win a convincing decision and add a 6th world title to his illustrious career. In March 20th, 1992, Hearns lost this title on a split decision to his old foe, Iran Barkley. He's back! Iran Barkley is the Tommy Hearns killer. I don't understand.
He really is. He really is. He had his number.
Tommy Hearns did continue to compete. He would fight 8 more bouts, and he won his next 8 fights. You knew it was time. It's been. I haven't done it yet this season, I don't think. It's time for wrestling, folks. That's right. On June 23rd, 1997, Tommy Hearns appeared on a WWF telecast performing in a storyline where he was taunted and challenged by professional wrestler Bret the Hitman Hart, who claimed that Hearns had stolen the Hitman nickname.
Hitman Hearns is out here somewhere. He's the biggest thief in the whole city.
Wait a minute. If you need someone to point one of the greatest fighters of all time out to you, all right? Then I'd like to point right over here, Thomas Hitman Hearns, right there.
A 7-time world champion and 6-time...
Hearns ended up attacking Bret Hart's cousin, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, and knocking him down with a series of punches before entering the ring and breaking up the confrontation with the Hitman. I also remember this. I believe Stone Cold Steve Austin once called him the shit man. I thought that was kind of funny. And then also, Tommy Hearns did show up in the other wrestling company at the time as well, WCW, making an appearance at Cobo Hall for Halloween Havoc. I know because I had it on VHS. So Tommy Hearns, lightly interested in professional wrestling at the end of his career. He didn't want to wrestle, but he seemed to be dabbling.
Well, probably because he got the bug when he fought Martin Lawrence on the show Martin. That's in 1992. Well, it was 1994.
Well, maybe you acknowledge my skills when I kick your ass.
So what?
You heard me. Yeah, they call you the hitman. Well, I got a call from Sugar. He calls you the get hitman.
So he's like, wait a minute, I can pretend to fight.
Yeah, I can do this. This is all acting, right? I could do a whole episode of just wrestlers playing wrestlers on television shows, like when King Kong Bundy was on Married with Children, like for multiple times during a season. Sure. Anyway, neither here nor there. One last interesting thing about Tommy Hearns before we move on. On November 6, 1998, Hearns had a boxing match that featured a rare double knockdown. In it, Hearns and opponent Jay Schneider landed punches simultaneously during the very first round. Hearns a right hand to the chin and Schneider a left jab to the chin. Hearns was able to get up before the referee's count reached 10, but Schneider was not, and Hearns won by first round knockout. What a weird moment.
Yeah, he can't do that backing away from Tommy Hearns. You know what Schneider has to do is...
I need to look that one up because I want to see that
again. Maybe I was giving Hagler too much credit. Maybe all the cinematic stuff is the Hearns thing. He's the guy he's the real showman here.
Absolutely. You're right. He really
So maybe what we've truly discovered after this whole conversation is that Tommy the Hitman Hearns was the true showman of modern boxing in the 1980s. So that's really all I have for boxing, Randall. There are some stories I did want to talk about before we move on, if you got a minute.
Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any thoughts about the big James Harden trade that just came through today? Oh. James Harden is now on the Clippers. Finally got to be where he wanted to be with the Clippers. if you're asking my opinion, the Clippers get absolutely fleeced for picks by the Sixers. And the Oklahoma City Thunder get like a rogue pick swap somewhere in there. What are your thoughts? Are you feeling good for the Clippers? Are you feeling bad for James Harden? Are you feeling good or bad about the whole thing? Where are you at with this?
So I would never feel bad for James Harden. He has definitely chose his path. It just seems to befuddle everybody what his path really is. I am in the same camp as you. I think Philadelphia fleeced the Clippers because he pretty much said that's the only place he wanted to go, right? Yeah. He wanted to go to the Clippers. Now that, they could have, I guess, not done anything and just had him sit. But, I don't know. Obviously, the Clippers, this will be their big three with Kawhi and Paul George, right?
Well, so if you're trying to be positive about it, right, the Clippers are basically playing James Harden, Russell Westbrook, Kawhi Leonard, and Paul George, right? So I don't know
about Westbrook.
Yeah. So like if this was, 3 years ago, we'd be like, yo, this team is great. I don't know if this does it for you. If this does it for you, then yeah, this is a good win for the Clippers, I suppose.
I suppose. He at the end of the day, his career, he's going to be one of the most prolific scorers in NBA history. Mr. Yeah. Harden, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But he's not a championship player. He's just not, right? I mean, he's never been. He doesn't play defense. But I know Paul George and Kawhi Leonard both are very good defenders. Westbrook, at this point in his career, I don't know that he's really good at anything. I mean,
yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Right? I mean, so I don't know. I don't know if it's going to move the needle out there in the West for the Clippers. I don't know.
I don't know where to sit with the Harden thing, right? Like, I think he's probably one of those. He's like the best player of all time in the players I hate watching list. Like, he is so hard to watch actually play a game of basketball. It's tough. So, but I can't sit here and be like, oh, he stinks, because he certainly doesn't. There's times I would watch him and get frustrated because he's so hard to watch. And then he's like, how does he have 40 points? He looks like he's barely doing anything. It's tough. Like, he's just not a particularly likable character. I know that's not the world's super hottest take or anything, but, you know, I always kind of liked Russell Westbrook. At least Russell Westbrook seems like he's out here really trying. He gets like eight rebounds a game as a guard, which is always great for me. I mean, you know, he seems to want to be out there more than Kawhi does. And I guess Paul George is really the best of these four, right?
Yeah, and I mean, really, with the Clippers, it's, you know, it's going to be the health, because Kawhi and Paul George both seem to be injury prone. Yeah. Westbrook is old. Harden's getting older. So health will play a big part in their season as well.
If you want to know why I think the Sixers fleeced the Clippers here, even though they only got back Robert Covington, Nicholas Batum, Marcus Morris, and Kenyon Martin Jr., that's because all four of those guys are on expiring contracts, and they got a lot of picks back. So my thought would be is that the Sixers are actually going to take all of this stuff and make a move down the road here. They're going to add another piece to this team with the parts that they just got from the Clippers. These picks, these players who are, again, people are going to want that money off at the end of the year. So that's easily tradable stuff. I wouldn't be shocked to see Philadelphia go after a disgruntled star the way that I was hoping the Knicks are going to have to as the year goes on.
No, you're right. They definitely set themselves up for flexibility. So even if they don't do that, those are, you know, the first round picks. So, I mean, not that that's a sure thing in the NBA by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, it's good assets to have.
And that's really, I don't really want to get into the Knicks. They're like 2-2. So there's really nothing to talk about. I don't know how you're feeling about the Bulls so far.
Not good, but you know, they didn't do anything to change the roster. So it's like, I don't know what they expect.
My boy Alex Caruso looks pretty good, though. We all love Alex Caruso. I got to love and protect Alex Caruso.
We do. We do love Alex Caruso.
You know what, though? I actually kind of like some of the guys in that Bulls team. I watched a couple minutes of like a Bulls game a couple nights ago. I think there's some guys I like. DeRozan. Like, I like DeRozan and LaVine a little bit.
I like them, but I mean, I just don't. That's not a winning roster. There's just not enough there. So whether you like them or not, they're just not going to win.
And finally today, keeping up with our ending the show on a non-sports segment, apparently, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the passing away earlier this week of Friends star Matthew Perry. Died at the age of 54, apparently drowning, found dead in his hot tub. Do you have any thoughts? No foul play is suspected. A lot of things I've read said that there were no like drugs found in his system or anything like that. People very genuinely sad and shocked. Do you have any thoughts about Matthew Perry or what happened here?
Well, I mean, it was funny. I was my daughter Evelyn called me and told me that Matthew Perry drowned, and I'm like, come on, you're kidding, right? It's a joke.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I'm not kidding. It really happened. Check it out. So, it's just one of those things. Like I, as you know, Sam, I lived in New York City in the '90s, right? I was there from '94 to '02. So Friends. Friends was during that time. So it was huge, right? So while, you know, my lifestyle wasn't anything like theirs, the show, living in New York, but it was still, you know, it was still an iconic show, and it really Seinfeld was Friends and Seinfeld, the two New York shows at the time that were very, very popular. So, and I mean, I've always enjoyed the show. I thought Chandler was probably the best character on the show. He was the funniest actor on the show.
Yeah.
I wanted him to do more afterwards than he did. There were a few shows that he was on that, you know, that were funny, but just didn't click.
That's something I think about, because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, God, it feels like there could have been so much more that he could have done. Like, I like the movie Almost Heroes, don't get me wrong, but that's probably not what he thought he was getting when he stepped into Hollywood with a Chris Farley movie. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
But I think we also now in hindsight kind of know why his career did sort of stall out there for a while. He had a lot of problems, it does seem like, in terms of drugs, addiction. Now, I have to admit, I'm younger than you, Randall. So I was Friends. I'm not going to be ashamed to admit here. That was on at the height of my interest. Seinfeld and Friends, much the same way I think of The Simpsons, were defining influential pop culture on my teenage years. They were inescapable pieces of pop culture that I would think about all the time and revisit with the same similarity that I revisit things like The Sopranos, which I'm watching like once a year. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
And when I was in high school and middle school, like, I definitely modeled a lot of my character beats on Chandler Bing, like being the funny, sarcastic guy. That was a way to like present myself as a young man who was not like a big, strong sports dude. Like, how do I interact with people? Oh, look at this guy. He's like a funny guy. I could sort of do that. And I was surprised how sad it made me thinking about this, because of how much I liked Matthew Perry during that period. He was my favorite character on the show. And I I feel like I did like the Chandler hairstyle when I was in high school in the middle. Like, I mean, I did that, like the way that girls did the Aniston hairstyle. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Get out, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out.
What?
You move out. Take your fruit, your stupid small fruit, and get out.
You want me to move out? I gotta tell you, man, I mean, it's kind of out of the blue. I mean, don't you think?
This is not out of the blue. This is smack dab in the middle of the blue.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, because I think that, I mean, my daughter, Evelyn, she's 18, right? She's watched Friends. I mean, because now it was big on Netflix for a while, right? Because it went to Netflix. It's all over. I mean, you can catch it on almost any streaming service. But I, like you said, it was kind of written for my generation, but then every generation since has come to enjoy it, so to speak, or somewhat, I should say. Not everybody loves it, but you know, it's pretty well regarded.
Yeah, I like the new. I like when the new round of critiques comes out for Friends for like things that we were critiquing on the show at the time. They're like,
yeah,
how could they afford those apartments? I'm like, yeah, we know, we've already talked about it. We know,
yeah,
we've,
exactly.
Even then, we knew it was expensive and unrealistic.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely,
yeah. All right, Randall, this was a lot of fun. I appreciate you taking the time here today. Next week, we are getting into episode 4, which I think we're doing Morgana. Is that our next episode?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful, Morgana. And then something else that I found at the last minute.
Yes.
So Morgana and something else next week, folks. We will see you then.